Thank you, again, Romero, for inviting me. I was going to say, Romero, did you spoil my thunder? Yes, my wife went here, so special place in my heart or something like that. Okay. Yes? Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. I was trying to think about what to talk about late at night, which is always a hard slot. People are eating, so I guess it's a little easier, but whatever. So this week's parsha is a pretty good parsha to find things to talk about. But on the other hand, it shouldn't be like too heavy and too like, I don't know if you girls like musr or don't like musr. I guess if you're in Rabbi Natanel's class, you probably do like musr or whatever. I know Rabbi Natanel or Rabbi Leibowitz for a lot of years. I did NCSY call for 9 years, so I know him for a long time. Basically, I want to talk about a couple of things tonight. The first is going to be about clearing your mind from distractions when it comes to Avodas Hashem. But the way that we're going to get there is not going to be probably like an obvious route in your mind. You'll see how it ties in. And then the second half, which hopefully also kind of segue from the first half, will be about sacrificing, not like necessarily literally, but sacrificing certain things as part of Avodas Hashem also. Those are the two major topics. So the beginning of Parshas Va'era, we know, of course, that's the stage for the Makos. But before we get to the actual Makos, Hashem appears to Moshe and makes this like a very odd kind of statement. He says, I'm finally appearing to you as Yudke Vavke, right? And the Avos, I only appeared as Kel Shakai, right? There's a lot of different explanations of what exactly that means, what those different names of Hashem represent, which I'm not going to get into right now because it's kind of beyond the scope and it's also kind of late. But I wanted to talk about an approach that's given by probably my favorite new Chumash Sefer, which you've probably never heard of before. It's called the Haksava HaKabbalah. It was written by a rabbi who lived in Germany in the late 17th, early 1800s. His name was Rav Yaakov Tzvi Mecklenburg. He was a super anti-reform, anti-Haskalah, if you ever learned Jewish history before, like very against all of that. And it's very, very clear from his writings that he was against a lot of that. But we're not even going to focus on that aspect of it tonight. But what we're going to talk about is the way that Hashem expresses himself to Moshe and to the Jewish people as a whole, and how that relates to us having to clear our minds and our heads when it comes specifically to Avodas Hashem. So we'll start out by mentioning something in the beginning of the parsha, where Hashem says to Moshe in the parsha, Asher nasasi es yadi. Hashem is referring to the fact that he promised the Avos that we would be given Eretz Yisrael. And the Torah uses the expression, Asher Nasasi Es Yadi, literally that I've lifted my hand. And we know that many places in Tanakh, that expression typically refers to some sort of a shvua, some sort of an oath that Hashem took, or that anyone took. In this context, it's referring to the fact that Hashem promised to give Eretz Yisrael to us, which of course we already know back from the beginning of Sefer Bereishis. So, Rav Mecklenburg in his Sefer points out the following idea. He says that the reason why the Chumash uses in this week's parasha the phrase Nasasi Es Yadi, that I'm going to lift my hands up as an oath that you're going to be given Eretz Yisrael. So he says that idea refers to what he calls a Pirsum Vigilui, like a spiritual revelation. It's this idea that Hashem was going to show and display to us the fact that we were going to be granted Eretz Yisrael. He also points out another interesting idea, that the word Masa, Mem Sin Aleph, is often used to refer to a nevuah. Now, the word masa literally means like a burden, right? Something like heavy that you're schlepping on your shoulders. But I don't know how many of you ever learned Sefer Malachi. It's pretty like out there. If you ever learned Tanakh, the word masa appears there. It appears in a few other places in Tanakh in the context of nevuah. And the question is, what does that word masa, literally a burden, have to do with nevuah? It doesn't seem to have anything to do with nevuah. So he offers two possibilities. He says, first of all, the word masa as a burden means that Hashem is essentially, when a person gets nevuah, and we know this from the Gemara, that a person loses all of their physical abilities, with the exception of Moshe Rabbeinu, right? Every other Navi who ever had nevuah essentially went into some form of like a seizure, right? They just kind of lost control of their body, and then they somehow were granted nevuah. What was the reason? Why did Hashem have to do that? Why couldn't Hashem just give nevuah when they were just standing up? Why did he have to make them lose all of their, you know, human functions to get nevuah? So he says, he explains, the reason is because in order for a person to connect spiritually to Hashem, you need to be divested. You have to be kind of stripped of all of your physicality. Because if you're so ingrained in your physical body, in your physical self, it's very difficult to connect to Hashem. And in almost the opposite, almost like a corollary of this, He says the word masa can also be similar to the word mas, mem samach, which often refers to taxes. We know this if you ever learned Megillas Esther, right? The end of Megillas Esther. Yasem hamelech achashverosh mas, right? He levied a tax. Why is that word used to refer to raising taxes? So he explains that this it's an idea of elevation. Obviously, we don't elevate a tax, but you impose a tax on somebody. So the word mas can also refer to our lofty spiritual goals that we have. Right? In other words, that it doesn't just mean that we have to remove ourselves from our physical selves, but also that by doing that, we're able to elevate ourselves spiritually and thereby connect to Hashem. Okay, so that's the first idea of what's being expressed in the beginning of the parsha. He also points out a really interesting idea regarding the word yad. Remember, the pasuk says, "Asher nasasi et yadi." So again, "Asher nasasi" is the idea of elevating yourself and kind of stripping down all of the physicality. And then the word yadi or the word yad can also have two meanings. The word yad, he says, can be an allusion to the light of nevuah, to the idea that Hashem illuminates and lightens up the eyes of a navi and allows the navi to see beyond the physical realm, to see what's in kind of what we call the nistaros, the things that are hidden. He also points out, and I don't know if any of you ever noticed this before, what's the Hebrew term that we use to refer to the banks of a river, like the river shore? What do we usually call that? Sfat Hayam or Al Yad Hayardin. Remember the expression for Al Yad Hayardin? Why is the word Yad refer to the banks of a river? So he says, because the river flows outwards, right? River, you know, it'll go beyond the shoreline. So the word yad in this context can also mean when Hashem, gives us extra bracha, right? He imposes or he kind of rains down extra bracha upon us. In fact, the word bracha itself, according to many mefarshim, comes from the word brecha, like a pool, like an overflowing pool, right? So it's a very similar idea also. So just in these four words, we already have four ideas, right? We have nasasi, that Hashem basically wants the Navi to remove his physical self to connect to him and thereby elevate himself and connect to Hashem. And the word Yadi, which we said can either refer to this like illumination where you connect to Hashem spiritually, and also Hashem kind of reciprocates and gives us back that physical light and that illumination that we're looking for. Okay, probably one of the biggest questions that every person ever since we've been like in first grade have had in Tanakh is how could Hashem harden Paro's heart, right? Everyone knows this question, right? This is like the most famous question of all time. So the truth is that this sefer that I alluded to before, the Haksava HaKabbalah, kind of shrugs this whole question off, and he says that you're completely misunderstanding the psukim if you're asking this question at all. I'll just tell you something interesting. I don't know if any of you ever learned Daf Yomi or started Daf Yomi or whatever, but there's a story that appears in the Gemara in Brachos from about a week and a half ago or so from Daf Yomi about Rabbi Meir and his wife Bruria. Okay, the story was there were these people who lived in his town who were, causing trouble, and they were whatever, they were bothering him a lot, apparently a lot, because he wanted to kill them. So, whatever. Basically, he wanted to, use Shem Hashem or use some kind of mystical method or something to kill these people who were really bothering him. Whatever, they were probably really bothering him. So his wife, Bruria, said, you can't do that because the Pasuk says, Itamu chataim in ha'aretz u'rishayim odeinam, right? We tell that in Tehillim and the Baruch Inashi. That basically, once the sins stop, they will no longer be sinners. So she said, instead of davening that they should, die, daven that they should do tshuva, right? Sounds like a good idea. So the Marsha, who's one of the commentaries, especially on Haggadah, asks, how could a person ever daven for another person to do tshuva? Isn't that a violation of Bechira, right? If I daven that someone who's doing Averos should stop doing Averos, like, what right do I have to do that? It's not up to me. It's up to that person. It's a pretty powerful question. So that type of question could be asked here also regarding Paro. However, he tries to kind of reinterpret the entire story regarding Paro. He says the following. He says that the reason why Hashem brought all of the Makos, we'll leave Makas Bechoros on the side because Makas Bechoros was a little bit different, but at least the first nine Makos for sure, were purely for the purpose of demonstrating that HaKadosh Baruch Hu runs the world. In fact, if you look in this week's parasha, in the beginning of next week's parasha also, it's very obvious that all the Makos, right, it says, Laman Saper Shemi Bechol Haaretz, Laman Teda Kein Kamoni Bechol Haaretz, it's just again and again, you hear the same idea. The reason why these Makos are happening is so that you should know that there's nobody like me in the world. The purpose of the Makos was not to rescue Klal Yisrael. Hashem could have done that in a second. He didn't have to drag this whole process out. He didn't have to wait. We didn't have to wait a whole year and have the Mitzriim go through all these Makos. Just take us out, right? The fact that Hashem did these Makos was more for the Mitzriim than it was for us. It was to demonstrate to them the fact that HaKadosh Baruch Hu was real and the fact that we were His chosen nation. But here, But here's the question. So we just said the purpose of the Makos was more for the Mitzrayim. So we know, of course, that Paro, when Moshe first approaches him last week's Parsha and says, you know, basically, let my people go. So what's Paro's initial response? Mi Hashem asher ashma b'kolo l'shalach es Yisrael. Who is this guy that I should release the Jewish people? And if you look very carefully, Paro specifically uses the name Yudke Vavke. Mi Hashem asher ashma b'kolo, right? Why is that significant? Because Paro, and this is a really interesting way to look at the story, the reason why Paro was so stubborn about letting the Jewish people go is because he had the same question that we all have about the Makos, which is, why didn't Hashem just skip the Makos and take the Jewish people out? Right? It would have made things a lot easier for everyone. So Paro's like, I don't get it. If this God is real, why do you have to bargain with me to release the Jewish people? Just take them out. You're God. Like, just take them out. So Paro, the very fact that Hashem didn't do that is what blinded Paro to the validity, to the truthfulness of God. Because, and again, the question is, so why didn't Hashem do that? Simple answer is because Hashem wanted to give them an opportunity to do tshuva, just like he does to any wicked person, right? Hashem wasn't going to drop a bolt of lightning on them the first second that they did anything. He says, okay, I'm going to drag this out. I'm going to give you a chance to do tshuva. Eventually, you know, it built up too much, or you know, to the point where it was no longer a viable option to do tshuva anymore, right? Which could also relate to the whole, how could Hashem harden Paro's heart? Maybe after a certain point, right, Paro hardened his own heart. Maybe at a certain point, there was no recourse anymore, right? Paro was given so many chances to do tshuva, and he just failed every single time. Again, so the reason why Hashem didn't just take us out in 1 second and just ignored all these parshios is because Hashem wanted to give the Mitzrayim a chance to do tshuva. That's a pretty unbelievable thing, if you think about it, because we're sitting here in Mitzrayim for 210 years being afflicted and being tortured. Also, the Mitzrayim can do tshuva or have a chance to do tshuva. That's a pretty crazy thing, right? It's like Hashem is delaying the Geula in order to give the Mitzrayim a chance to do tshuva. But we've seen that the concept of tshuva for anybody is so powerful that Hashem has to allow that opportunity to at least theoretically be present. Now, the other thing, so again, that point that we mentioned is the very thing that blinded Paro. The fact that Hashem is merciful and that he allows people the chance to do tshuva is what eventually causes Paro to not let them go. Okay, so just to summarize, this is kind of the first part. So just to summarize this idea, basically we spoke about the idea of nasasi, right? The idea of elevation, of having to kind of strip down all the physicality to connect to Hashem. We spoke about the fact that when you connect to Hashem, so Hashem elevates you, which is also part of the word yad, and Hashem pours all of his bracha out on you. And we addressed the question about how could Hashem harden Paro's heart? And then the other question, why didn't Hashem just take us out right away? Which we basically said, because Hashem wanted to give the Mitzrayim the chance to possibly do tshuva. Okay, so this is all the first part. Now, this, I just wanted to make this kind of one point from this first part of this year, which is that Hashem, very clearly, as we just said, is giving the Mitzrayim a chance to do tshuva. And sometimes, for us, you know, sitting in this room, or for us in life, so oftentimes, we don't necessarily understand why things happen. I'll tell you a story. It's like a very, very personal story. Not like, whatever, you'll see. It's a very personal story. But basically, my wife's sister-in-law, so my wife's brother's wife, so her family, her two older brothers were nifter last year, within like 6 months of each other. They were in their 20s. It was like sudden, both times. It was crazy. It was a really crazy year. So basically, most people don't know how to respond to a tragedy, let alone two tragedies. And especially when the tragedies happen to very young people, right? It's like just like what are you supposed to do? So I never really had any experience. The only thing that I ever had in my life like that wasn't at all like that was my grandfather, who was relatively young. He was like in his early 60s, which is young, but it's not anything close to being in your 20s. And I just remember, like, I'm kind of at a loss for words. Like, what are you supposed to do, right? And I remember that my sister-in-law's father at the time, you know, it's obviously very, very hard when you're doing shiva for your kids, for more than one kid, but he decided to basically try and finish all of Shas by the first one's your time, the second one's your time is coming up in like a month or whatever. They tried to finish all of Shas in their memory. And the truth is that, you know, learning Torah is one of the few things that we know how to do well, no matter what situation we're in, right? Because, meaning, for many of us, so let's say, I don't know, we're on a summer program, we're in seminary, we're in college, we're doing whatever. So in theory, the one constant that's supposed to be in your life, whether it's for 5 minutes a day or for 10 hours a day, is learning Torah, right? Now, yes, there are days when you're not allowed to learn. It's on Tisha B'Av. And if, God forbid, you're an Avelis, right? But I'm saying in general, most normal days of your life, Torah is supposed to be present somewhere in your life, right? And Torah, regardless of how much or how little you learn, is supposed to define your life, right? Meaning you're supposed to live a life of Torah, and you're supposed to have Torah learning and mitzvos as a part of your life. I think that one of the things that we probably overlook a lot, or we don't pay enough attention to, is the fact that we kind of just go through the motions after a while. You know, maybe for some of us, it's like maybe our first real exposure to learning, or maybe it's our first serious exposure to, like, I don't know, how people yell at you for not doing the right thing, whatever, or just like not spending enough hours, I don't know, doing chesed or doing Torah or whatever, which is all great. But the problem is that eventually we have to own up to, you know, ourselves, and we have to say, how do I take everything that I've done or that I've in the past or that I will do and kind of make that part of my life? So just like Hashem is giving Paro and the Mitzrayim chance after chance after chance to do tshuva, so this might be a good mashal for some of you, a terrible mashal for others, but I'll just say it anyway. Imagine like your year in seminary is like your chance to do tshuva for everything you've done in the past. That's whatever. Probably doesn't work for most of you. But if it does, then it does. If it doesn't, then great. Meaning, at a certain point in your life, everyone has to take stock of what they've done and just be like, okay, how am I going to change myself? How am I going to be better? Right? And by the way, that doesn't mean that you're like doing averos left and right. It just means that I'm not as committed to Torah learning or to doing chesed or to whatever, to davening, right? At a certain point, Hashem says, okay, enough is enough. Let's figure out how we're gonna move on. And that actually segues into the second part of what I want to talk about, which is also related to one of the specific makos from this week's parsha, which is Makas Tzfardea. We all know about Makas Tzfardea, even though some of the Mefarshim claim that there were alligators, but we all assume that they were frogs. Yeah, the Ibn Ezra and Ibn Ezra claim they were alligators. But there's a very, very odd Gemara about Makas Tzfardea. It's a Gemara in Pesachim. It's alluded to a little bit in the Gemara in Ksubis, also by some of the Rishonim. Okay, anyone here ever heard of Sefer Daniel before? Okay, wow, that's way more than in any yeshiva. So, what class? Okay, fair enough. So, you all know the story of Hanani, Mishael, Azariah, vaguely, fiery furnace, didn't want to bow down to Nebuchadnezzar's idol statue thing. It's not clear if it was a statue, an idol, it's a whole machlokas, right? So they get thrown into a furnace, and then a malach comes, or someone who's like a malach, and then saves them, right? Why did Hanani, Mishael, Azariah decide to not bow down, just be thrown into the furnace? What's the simplest answer to that question? Hashem, Avodah Zarah, right? Again, that's a whole debate in the Rishonim, if it was really Avodah Zarah or not. Leave that on the side. It's kind of too, you know, it's too late at night to talk about that. But whatever. Bottom line is, Hanani, Mishael, Azariah were thrown into a furnace for something to do with, I don't know, Chil Hashem, Avodah Zarah, something along those lines. Where did they figure this out from? The Gemara says something very, very odd. I don't know if you, in your Daniel class, learned this Gemara. The Gemara in Pesachim says they made a Kal V'Chomer. You know what Kal V'Chomer is? Kal V'Chomer? They made a Kal V'Chomer from the frogs. What was their Kal V'Chomer from the frogs? What do the frogs do? Some of the frogs jumped into the furnace, Uvetanu Recha, right? They jumped into the oven, so they obviously died, presumably, right? So the Gemara says, if the frogs, who were never commanded by Hashem to do anything in the first place, they gave their lives up for the sake of Kiddush Hashem, right? So us, who are commanded to sacrifice our lives for Kiddush Hashem, we should certainly be thrown into a furnace or jump into the furnace or whatever. Okay, very, very odd, but that's what the Gemara says. There's another Gemara in Maseches Ketubot that seems to have, doesn't talk about Tzfardea specifically, but has almost the opposite effect. The Gemara says that had Nebuchadnezzar threatened Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah instead of with death, but with lashes, with getting whipped, they would have bowed down. Which is also really weird, because, like, I don't understand. Like, if you're going to give your life up, why would you take a couple of hits, a couple of lashes? So the Rishonim talk about, well, it could be because death, at least you know there's an end. With lashes, you're just going to keep getting beat and tortured and endlessly, so maybe psychologically there's a difference. This idea of giving your life up, which again we learn from Tzfardea, which we learn from Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah, is maybe hard for most of us to relate to, hopefully. Maybe less so in the world today, but, you know, generally speaking, most of us are, you know, not going to encounter these kinds of issues anymore today, hopefully. But there is still a way that we can inculcate the concept of Mesiras Nefesh, of what we call self-sacrifice, into our lives, not necessarily in an extreme fashion, like give your life up type of thing, but something that we can actually all relate to. So before I tell you what that is, I'll just give you a quick idea that's quoted in the name of Rav Chaim Shmulevitz. It's quoted in the Sefer Sichos Mezer. It's a really beautiful idea. The Gemara in Megillah says that Moshe Rabbeinu had multiple names. Right? The Gemara says he had name Yekusiel and Zanoach and Chever and Socha, all these other names, Tuvio, Avigdor. So why do we call him Moshe? In fact, if anything, Moshe was the name given to him by Bas Paro. So why would we call him based on a name given to him by an Egyptian woman? It seems really odd. He had a lot of other names. Says Rechayim Shulev, it's the following idea. He says, Bas Paro risked everything, possibly even her life, in order to save Moshe. Why? Because Paro, her father, decreed all the boys have to be killed, right? So she directly violated a decree of her father to spare the life of Moshe Rabbeinu. Says Rav Chaim Shmulevitz, the trait of Mesiras Nefesh, of self-sacrifice, in this case almost literal, is so important, it's so significant, that Moshe was called based on the name given to him by Bas Paro, because every leader needs to have that quality of being willing to sacrifice, whether literally or in other ways. Okay? That's why he's called Moshe, because of the sacrifice that Bas Paro underwent in order to save his life. So, getting back to the idea of self-sacrifice. Again, we're not talking about literally having a gun to your head. How do we incorporate sacrifice into our lives? So, I don't know about you, I went to Shalavim a long time ago, and the food there was terrible. The dorms have gotten a lot better, but they were terrible when I was there. Nothing about the physical existence of my 2 years in yeshiva was good. Pretty much. Almost nothing. There were a few things, but almost nothing. But you don't go to yeshiva or seminary for the food or for whatever else you think you're going to get. I mean, in some places you do, but I don't know. Not in Shalvin. So some people make small sacrifices, right? So anyone here learn Pirkei Avos? Some of Pirkei Avos, all Pirkei Avos, none of Pirkei Avos. So we all know that really long Mishnah that's kind of not a Mishnah, but a Braisa, the 48 ways to acquire Torah, right? All the way at the end, right? So there are a lot of different things the Mishnah or the Braisa says you need to do to acquire Torah, right? Like, for example, don't sleep a lot. I'm great at that. I have a kid. Don't sleep a lot. I have another one coming, so not going to be sleeping for the next bunch of years. Thank you. Okay. But don't sleep a lot. It says don't eat a lot. Don't drink a lot. Like, it's like, okay, so like just don't do anything. Just sit and learn all day. Which is basically what the Mishnah means. Just don't do anything other than like sit and learn and find good friends and learn with them, and you kind of just ignore everybody else. You know, I mean, not exactly that, but kind of along those lines. The Mishnah basically is telling us that in order for a person to become serious in their Torah learning, in their mitzvos, in chesed, in whatever it is that they want to excel at spiritually, you have to find a way to kind of cut out some of that physical world a little bit, right? Obviously, we still have to engage in the physical world. We're human beings, after all, right? We still have to... Okay, funny story. A little bit of funny story. My brother-in-law is learning in Shraga this year, and we started a WhatsApp group for kids in Shraga to ask whatever questions they want, which is probably not a great idea, but whatever. So the first question I got was, if there's a thing called Gehenim, why is there also a thing called Gilgulim, which is like reincarnation? So I'm like, that's way above my pay grade, so I'm not... Whatever. But a semi-more normal question that I was asked, which is a little bit more normal.
That's a good question.
What? No, my brother-in-law is in Shraga. I gave a shir at Shraga a few nights ago, whatever. Long story. Anyway, so one of the questions that was semi-more normal that was asked was, why does Hashem make us sleep? Isn't that Bittul Torah? Which if you hear the question, you're like, that sounds like a dumb question, but then you think about it again, you're like, maybe it's not such a dumb question. So this is what I thought. I don't know if this is right, but this is what I thought. So what I thought was, of course we have to sleep, and we have to eat, and we have to drink, and we have to go to the bath. Like, we're humans. Like, we get that. But, on the other hand, like we just pointed out, sometimes it requires minimizing certain things, right? Certain things that we would otherwise do for longer in order to actually excel at Torah and mitzvahs, right? Again, I'm not telling you to, like, sleep three less hours than you were last night. Like, if you need to sleep however many, like, the Rambam says you should sleep 8 hours a night. If you need to sleep 8 hours a night, sleep 8 hours a night. I don't remember the last time I slept 8 hours a night. But if you need that, great. If it makes you more awake for learning Torah, that's the goal, right? In fact, by the way, some of the Gemaras that it came up in Daf Yomi recently in Brachos were all about how before a person, right, we say this in the beginning of Kriya Shema Lamita, right? Before you go to sleep, you ask Hashem, you know, to get rid of all the anger that you had, all the people you were upset at, and basically that your sleep and everything that you do, every physical activity that you do, should be for the purpose of serving Hashem more effectively, right? So I think one of the a way to think about the idea, the concept of Mesiras Nefesh in a way that's relatable to us is to say, how can I enhance my spiritual self? Again, not to say that I'm like throwing out my physical side, but to kind of balance it a little bit, right? To say, okay, maybe I can learn for an extra 5 minutes instead of wasting time doing X, Y, and Z, right? In other words, it doesn't have to like cut into my sleep. Like, let's say it takes me an hour to go to sleep from the time I'm done learning, so maybe it should take me 55 minutes instead of an hour. Just something small like that, right? So, and again, it doesn't mean I have to like eat dinner in 5 minutes. Like, you can enjoy life, like you should. But the point is that every person, to whatever extent they can, should try and find somewhat of a balance, because at the end of the day, we're physical and spiritual beings. And in fact, that's the thing that makes us greater than Malachim, right? If you look in Sefer Yecheskel, this comes up, it comes up in a few places in Tanakh also, where we're contrasted with Malachim, right? Malachim are referred to as Omdim. They're stagnant. They don't do anything because they're just spiritual, right? There's no growth for Malachim. In contrast, animals also have no growth. They're just purely physical beings. It's only humans who have this blend of we're physical, we're spiritual, we speak, we think, right? We have all these different traits kind of blended together, and that allows us to elevate ourselves. So we have the unique challenge of taking our physical selves and trying to elevate that spiritually, which is an incredibly difficult thing to do, because you're basically trying to mix two things that don't go together, and you're trying to elevate one and kind of, you know, tamper the other one. So our goal in life, essentially, is to balance the physical and the spiritual, is to use Torah as a means to say, okay, I have to be involved in the world, but I also have to kind of figure out a balance. I don't know if one, how much time do I don't know what time I have. We have time, okay. So I'll tell you a few quick ideas about this. So this is going to sound like a plug for, I don't know for what, but whatever. I'm speaking at Shalom for Women tomorrow. I'm going to share about the mitzvah of building a ma'akeh. Anyone know what that is? A ma'akeh? Like a fence around your roof, right? Basically, don't let people fall off and die, essentially, is what the mitzvah is all about. It's a pretty straightforward mitzvah. So one of the probably more metaphorical interpretations of that mitzvah is that building a fence can also mean to kind of fence yourself in spiritually. I'll explain what I mean by that. So, again, getting references back to that Jewish history thing I mentioned at the beginning. So, anyone here learned Jewish history or learning Jewish history, have learned in the past? Okay, so if you know anything about Jewish history from the times of the 1700s and 1800s, during the height of the Haskalah, the Reform, all of those things were essentially running against the grain of what we call, I'll call it normative or Orthodox Judaism, or whatever you want to call it. And one of the challenges that a lot of Rabbanim had, both primarily in Europe, but even a little bit in America, probably actually more so in America because there were less from Jews here, was to basically have a culture, have a religion that was part of the culture, but not too much part of the culture. Okay, we have this challenge today, but today this challenge is a lot easier because today, you know, our boundaries are very clearly defined. So even though, yes, we're part of society, but like we can kind of, you know where to draw the line. In the 1800s and 1700s, that wasn't so easy to do because people thought you were crazy if you, I don't know, kept Shabbos or if you kept kosher, because those things were more difficult, especially if you live in America in those times, right? So I'll give an example. One of the great Rabbanim who lived during that time period was the Chasam Sofer. Okay, the Chasam Sofer, right, was probably one of the most, I'll call him Harif, about this issue. This is going to sound weird. He was known as the first Haredi rabbi. I don't know if that makes you think lesser or more of him, but basically he was the first person to really be like, okay, we're Jewish, you're not Jewish, here's a fence, don't cross this fence. That's kind of what his philosophy was, and he was very strong about that. He was very into the idea of having very closed off communities, of not integrating into society at all, like at all. And that leads to a lot of controversial things, you know. And again, I'm not discussing the merits, you know, the pros and cons of that opinion. But the bottom line is that he writes in a lot of places in his work that, you know, the idea of having fences is so significant, it's so important, and he actually interprets the mitzvah of ma'akev, building a fence around your roof, in a spiritual fashion as well. We have to build fences around our spiritual lives to ensure that we don't fall prey to the things that are happening around us, which could mean anything, pretty much. And he's not the only one who says that. Lubavitch Rebbe has a shot similar to that as well, where he basically says that the whole idea of the mitzvah of ma'akeh is that Hashem allows us the opportunity to be able to grow, but with growth, and especially with exponential growth, which can often happen when you're in yeshiva and seminary, you need to know how to strike a balance, right? We always want to be like, okay, I spent the last X number of years not learning, let me just go crazy and learn for 1,000 hours. But eventually, you're going to burn yourself out if you do that, right? If you try, I'm not saying you shouldn't be intense. Some people are really intense. Some people are like more normal or less intense. I don't know. But the point is that you need to, even now, you have to strike a balance, right? So if you're going to spend the next week learning like nonstop, but then you're going to not learn at all the following week because you burned yourself out, like, it's not really worth it, right? You have to figure out what makes sense. Okay, so let's just kind of summarize. I know it was kind of a lot, but it's just three basic ideas. We started by talking about the idea, the concept of having clarity in Avodas Hashem. The notion that we have to have a clear mind, a clear head, when we're trying to figure out what's going on around us. Right? And we spoke about the idea of Paro. The reason, the very thing that blinded Paro from recognizing Hashem was the fact that Hashem was too merciful. The fact that Hashem gave him too many chances. He didn't just take them out right away. Hashem also similarly gives us those opportunities to be able to do tshuva, to be able to recognize the error of our ways and to actually improve on what we've done. We also spoke about the concept of Mesiras Nefesh, where we spoke about why Moshe was called Moshe, right? Because Bas Paro was Moser Nefesh to save him, and how basically each of us can incorporate the concept of Mesiras Nefesh into our lives by, you know, self-sacrifice. Again, not in necessarily in a literal sense, but, you know, basically less engagement with the physical world to whatever extent that's possible. And then, just and again, we spoke about that from the concept of Tzfardeya and Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah, right? How those things play together. And then the last thing we just spoke about was regarding, building fences, essentially, right? Separating yourself from the world outside, again, to whatever extent you're supposed to do that. So I think just the general takeaway message should be that we should all strive, again, to each person to their own level, their own ability, to be able not only to serve Hashem with a clear mind and a clear conscience, and not be like, I did all these terrible things before, so therefore I'm not fit to do this. Like, it's not true. Like, for example, the Mishnah says in Bava Metziah that if you go over to a ger and you say to the ger, remember when you used to eat lobster and now you're using that same mouth to talk to her? Like, that's an Isser Doraisa. It's called Onas Devarim. You're not allowed to, we'll call it, verbally abuse people, basically, which is what that is, right? So to start, telling people about all their past deeds or whatever it is a big problem. So we should always make sure that, first of all, we're working on ourselves, we're trying to be able to connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to the best of our ability, and also to try to whatever extent possible, I know, again, it's not necessarily an easy thing to think about, but to try and incorporate some level of Mesiras Nefesh into our lives, however we can do that, to just say, okay, I'm going to not do this as much as I was doing before. I'm going to spend 5 less minutes doing X and learning Torah, or doing Chesed, or doing whatever it is. It really doesn't matter. Just, it's more like a mindset. It's more like, I need to change the way that I think, so that this way I have more of an opportunity to clearly connect to Hashem. Thanks for listening.